Yeah, so right now we've started the recording for the next TrueFans session. I'm going to just introduce a little bit. The TrueFans Hangout is a monthly hangout for TrueFans, people who want to get an early and the latest on what's going on with open source ecology and get involved. Our goal is to create a lot of working teams where we really build a community as we go into the future. So that's welcome to it. And we'll wait for a few people to join up. But in the meantime, Andrew, thanks for the email about the updates in Australia. Yeah, we do want to get involved. I do want to get the chapters going. We have a regular set of conference calls to continue development on priority issues.
Yeah.
So that's definitely right in. And the way we're going about it right now is creating a bunch of working teams. If you go on the wiki, there's a list of working teams. If you search working teams on the wiki. Did someone just join us on the call? Maybe not. Okay. So with respect to the chapters, I mean, people like yourself, Andrew, I mean, that's a perfect segue to start a chapter. Since you've been here, you kind of know what we're about, and you've got definite interest on the ground with people building. Tell me the status. So you guys have land, right? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. That noise might have been Andrew. Might have dropped out. It might have been a dropping
like
noise.
Andrew. Okay. Maybe. Well, okay. They're building. They're. I mean, I believe they got land over there. And on the topic of chapters around the world. I mean, there's a number of different chapters. And I mean, the French chapter just started working on the solar concentrator. There's a number of requests from various groups. There's an OSE Milwaukee where they're doing some meetups and skills training. And that's a great way to get people involved with the work teams. And I was thinking that to facilitate the progress, we want to all work, pull together and pretty much swarm on projects so that it's not, a lot of projects don't get started and not finished, but we actually get considerable effort in the direction of the priority projects. So things that are getting prototyped, I mean, there's a lot of energy for things being prototyped here with our program here, including things like the workshop, the permaculture workshop that we're going to host in September this year. So we're actually getting our tractors and equipment up for that so we can do key line plowing, making ponds and bulldozing for drainage and erosion purposes. But on the chapters worldwide, an interesting concept is to, the thing we have to do is just start basic standards and procedures for how we work with chapters, basic governance issues, and we just have to write that down as we're building our community this year. That's where we are. I also noticed that the link for the Google Hangout has expired, which is weird because I thought there was a permanent link. Maybe I'll do as I'll say.
I hope that's not my fault. I clicked it earlier today, getting confused about the time zones.
Did it work?
It appeared to work, but there was nobody else in the Hangout.
That's weird. Let me try it again.
I'm not totally experienced with the Hangouts. I've only done it a few times.
Yeah, let me see if the Hangout works. There's always some issues about these Hangouts here. It's saying trying to join call, please wait. If it gets me in there.
I had to okay some plugins first. Mm-hmm. I think that just about every time I do it, I end up having to do that.
Right. Yeah. No, it's... Looks like that Hangout link is just not coming. networking. So I'm going to send a new link out on. I'm just going to send an email out to people. Has joined us.
I'm back.
Andrew, you're back?
Sorry, guys. Yeah.
How's the connection, by the way? I mean, is this a phone call line accessible to people, or is that too complicated?
I'm using Redtail to reduce the call rate because calling international from Australia is too much, and I don't think there's any other way to do it. Like Skype data would be too much as well if it went for like 2 hours.
What are you using? Did you say Redtail?
Redtail, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Let's see. Let me just send out a Google Hangout link. It appears the one I sent yesterday just simply expired. So allow me to just get that link out there again for a second here.
Okay, this is a little quiet.
Yeah, Andrew, as I do this here, tell me the latest on, one thing we are considering, of course, is the chapters idea. What's the latest on what you're doing there? You guys have secured the land? Andrew, can you hear us?
Hang on a sec. I'm going to try and put on some headphones because you're really quiet.
Okay.
That might really help me.
I'll try to speak up too. Is this any better?
I should be loud and clear, yeah.
Okay, great.
All right, so sorry, what was your question, Martin?
My question is what's the status? Do you guys have acquired land?
We're currently talking with Starseed about being able to give them a 10% share in the profits from setting up a makerspace there. So basically it allows us to scale without worrying about a massive outlay on the entry because Starseed have a lot of space that they're not using their community and they've got a lot of workshop space that we could set up in. So it basically means that ongoing our land would be free. And they would only take a share in the profits of the makerspace. That is after running expenses as well.
So the land, you're saying the land is bought by you and some friends, and you're letting the makerspace, another makerspace, or is that you guys?
Sorry. Typically, the land that I own is far away in Queensland, but the land we're currently talking about using is in Byron Bay. And that is owned by a community, a group of people called Starseed. And
okay. They
have a large space that isn't being used. And they are excited about the idea of being able to set up a makerspace there with the main purpose of that being to generate revenue to make open source hardware. And in order to use that space, after our operating costs for the makerspace, so that's not including, say, acquisition of new tools or anything like that, it's just replacing broken stuff and energy use, I would give them 10% of the profit from the makerspace to be able to use that land.
I see. So you're basically, and how much, I mean, the land, the maker space, I mean, is there also living space there, or is it just maker space?
Well, that's the next thing that we've got to work out with them. There's heat, there's a very large space on that land, and over time, as we get a CEB press going and we can actually put up walls, there's a lot of unused workshops that will be converted into living quarters. They're eventually going to set that up as a school to educate people, and their primary focus is on permaculture, but definitely having a makerspace there allows those students to tap into another resource as well.
Are they into open source permaculture? Or
I think everything that they talk about is usually acquired through books which people pay for, and I don't think that they've really thought about the whole open source thing because most of the stuff they're using is so low tech anyway. I can certainly talk to them about that. I don't think it's something they've really thought about.
Okay, that's cool. So let me actually start with what I wanted regarding the formal meeting today, what the update is for OSC, because it's about 6:15 and we're not getting too many people joining at this point, which a little surprise because I know Jonathan was supposed to be here and some other people. So this is our second meeting of the year. Welcome to this. The theme for this time around is building the OSC community and building the working teams. So last month I've talked about stepping back, regrouping, reorganizing to where we are as OSC. Basically, the last 4 years since the TED Talk have been a lot of different proofs of concept, extreme builds, getting the machine to be built in a single day, people replicating things, us building houses as the final proof of the brick press working. And we've started to develop a business model for how we can scale this, for example, through workshops. And the concept with extreme manufacturing being that if we get the production down to be very efficient, then we can host workshops. People can walk out of that with a product, whether it's a brick press or a house over a longer period, and there's revenue to be made from the actual products and the immersion education experience. So we're trying to bootstrap ourselves that way and try to invite the community, the greater community, to the concept of distributive enterprise where we develop together and everyone has access to pretty refined business plans and documents and designs for example, how you guys can run a brick press workshop or make a 3D printer workshop where a lot of 3D printers are produced with very high quality. So the key is having products that are high quality and well-developed, which makes this possible, and also produced by social production, which is how you can embody the education and production in one. So the last few years have been quite amazing. But this year, as we go into 2015, we want to revamp a lot of our processes and how we operate with a fresh focus on the global community. I just published a 4-year review blog post. You can go to the blog. If you go to opensourceecology.org, you can look at the blog section, and there's the 4-year review. So we've learned a lot about how to manage, deal with a lot of moving parts and people, but like any organization, growth is both good and bad, in that when you're experiencing rapid growth, you have to keep up with it to absorb all the people and all the energy that's coming to you. So finally, we're slowing down pretty much from an overflow of our extreme build workshops, interns, regrouping and reorganizing our work, and we actually just have begun working teams, forming working teams, as a new way to to stir up our large latent community back into action. So the main desirable outcomes for the year include really reworking the development method drastically. And that includes, the huge part of that is the community. How do we tap all these people that are coming our way, wanting to contribute, but in many cases just not being able to because maybe our information is confusing or we don't have established teams or processes. So the question is how to bring in new people, create team ecologies for effective development. One of the things that we're doing this year is the absolute final release of the Brick Press. Last year we've done some of the final improvements. We've tested the Brick Press and the new electronics, new drawer system in terms of, and use the machine to build our house. You can read about the concept of the distributive enterprise. It's also that's the last blog post on the blog. So you can look at that, how we're thinking about the community generating revenue. Because the thing is, a lot of people come and go, but the thing that will make the community really strong is an economic function. That is, for us, that means we ship product, we teach people how to build that so a lot of people can build it for themselves, build it for sale, build it for workshops, and that way the whole movement grows. Because if you look at the patterns of successful open source projects, one pattern is that you have a strong core development team, but the other pattern is that you have to have some strong support, either build a huge community or get support from some strong economic organization that can fund the continued and organized development. That's what we're trying to make OSE into, one, an organization that supports all this development, but also a strong community that generates revenue from the economic value of what we're working on. So this year, shifting to the working teams. We've started a number of them. This week we have started and are starting new ones, but this week we met for the first time with a graphics working team. Part of that is about the development method. It's developing a pattern language of icons related to open hardware development so we can communicate about things more easily, whether it's about how things are designed or how a process works, or for example, one is design. You can represent machines and modules with icons. You can put them together to represent machines. That's part of the development method, where our goal is to make our documentation useful, forkable, being able to be built upon. It's at this point, it's still quite not well organized. We have started a community development working team, where the goal is to attract, train, and involve existing and new contributors by leveraging our greater open source hardware community. We've also been meeting with our business strategy working team to develop the revenue-generating enterprise models that OSE developers can use to support development. We need to start a few more teams, and that is an IT web working team. We're actually going to reorganize the forum and the wiki the forum for bringing on pretty much newbie contributors. That's a great way to do that. But wiki, creating various templates and improved organization to handle a larger amount of traffic in the long term. Because right now we're not set up to handle a lot of different people. We need to reformulate a lot of that. In terms of enterprise development, we're having our first meeting of the CEB Press working team tomorrow, and that is to develop the CEB Press distributed production enterprise, meaning basically we publish the final blueprints and show people how they can work with a local fabricator to build it themselves, and then deeper, how eventually that will evolve into how do you build a house with it, how do you organize an event that's actually self-sustaining by its economics where you produce real housing. Okay. The two other things on the enterprise front, we're actually considering the 3D printer workshop. So we're starting a 3D printer working team, and that is to develop an extreme manufacturing replicable weekend workshop for producing 24 3D printers with high quality control. So basically, we've seen that we can run 3D printer workshops. We actually ran one last year. But we'd like to really refine it to make it highly replicable, that we can absorb people to do that with us. And if you produce 24 3D printers, the basic revenue model there is if you charge for the materials, you charge a workshop admission price on top of that, and say you're charging $300 for this workshop, and 24 people would be $7,200 worth of revenue. So that could be a very robust enterprise model. So we're looking at that, and if we have a person doing that full-time, we can potentially run one or two workshops per month. So even with that, you know, say you... 50, if you run two workshops, that's 50 printers times 12 months or 10 months, that's like 500 printers a year. We're trying to make such an operation quite replicable, and the key is streamlining the production to a single day. One or 2 days, actually, would still work. Nobody's really doing it that rapidly. The closest to that, I think, is a three-day workshop that the 3D4EDU project is doing. That's the Joshua Pierce's group up in Michigan Tech. But basically, use the existing know-how in the 3D printer community, refine it, and make a replicable workshop around that. And I think that's pretty much low-hanging fruit because that technology is very well developed, up to things like automatic bed leveling, where that makes the calibration really, you know, much easier. So the next one is the aquaponics greenhouse working team, and that is to develop a replicable enterprise model for basically the whole layout and detailed ecology of an 800 square foot aquaponics greenhouse that could feed a family of four for about like 80% of their food. And we're going to try to push the limits on that. Is it really possible to do that, or even up to 100% if you really refine all the techniques? Because to us, the missing link is the knowledge to make it happen. We think that this can be scalable. We want to build this prototype on Microhouse 4, and later in the year, we're aiming to build our workshop, the larger workshop, which is the electronics workshop, which will have a larger greenhouse in front of that, about 2,000 square foot greenhouse. We'd like to achieve a dollar per square foot per week production value from the crops that are generated from that using a CSA model, community supported agriculture. So that's a very specific goal we have for this year. And with that, if we can show that or get far in doing that, we're looking at recruiting a person that can run that operation with us and make it an open enterprise model, as always, so that people can replicate this virally. I mean, I think this has great potential. The food industry is a $1 trillion industry. No question that everyone eats food. I don't think anyone argues that. The market for that is huge, especially for high-quality, organic, locally grown food. That can be a potential killer app. Okay, so that's the aquaponics, 3D printer, CV press, three different revenue models that we're developing. And the last working team that we will start up in the next couple of weeks will be the tractor construction set working team. So what we're going to do there is move back a little bit to a smaller scale tractor that can be made into a feasible product. That would be a tracked micro tractor, kind of like maybe the Toro Dingo, if you look that up. But when we approach this, because we have the modules, the frame modules, power cube modules, wheel modules, everything is independent, we can work like a construction set to build anything from a micro tractor to a tractor to a bulldozer and backhoe, just like Andrew with the back. No, Andrew back. No, you weren't there with the backhoe. You were with a bucket. But yeah, right. So. And those pieces of equipment will be there for the September permaculture design course that we're hosting at Factory Farm with Mark Shepard, September 12th through the 19th is the current plan date. At that point, we will finally debut with our heavy equipment in real regenerative agriculture action. So that's looking quite exciting. I think we're there that we can make this happen. We'll make sure that we get a lot of development happening on it, especially with the permaculture course runner, that's Mark Shepard, and his team to collaborate on this equipment. So that's kind of that in a nutshell regarding the different working teams. Now, on other fronts, I'm excited to be going to the Permaculture Voices Conference next week. And I aim to come back having recruited some key contributors to the aquaponics greenhouse working team, which will then transition to a larger team of open enterprise models for a highly replicable production CSA. So of the CSA is intended to be the basis for our work in regenerative agriculture, where the CSA provides the revenue, the business model, to fund a lot of other agriculture work and expansion of that to field crops, nursery, bakery, just high revenue business models around things that you can produce on a farm. So that's pretty much in a nutshell what we've been up to. And maybe I can open this up to discussion now, maybe talk a little bit more about if you guys have questions and where this is all going. The central theme being reshifting from ad hoc development where, you know, a contributor would come here and there might be some discussion. I mean, I was at the center of a lot of that, so definitely that's a huge bottleneck that we need to address and for which we're developing the working teams, where after we start the team, we develop a leader within that team so that these teams can go on pretty autonomously as long as they're following the OSE specifications. But that's a great way to get people on board. If there's a new person, they can join a working team. And it's kind of like meritocracy, essentially. It's like when you join, you're guided, well, you're judged by your product. You keep a log, you contribute to a working group, and then you get credibility within the organization, and then you can pick up to leadership. But we'd like to develop these teams, especially with the focus that some of these teams are working out on real enterprise. So the goal being only through the enterprise or a constant funding stream can we have continuous development in this project, and that's kind of killing us that people are coming and going because there's really no revenue models to support people. So we'd like to address that by the different revenue models that we're developing here. And I think the attractions can be pretty significant for that, because when people develop this, the hope is that we develop some of the best enterprise models that can be replicated by many other people. So the value model is everyone contributes to the development, but the plans are absolutely free, no messing around with any kind of protectionism or anything like that, just focusing on making sure that the development is open and collaborative so we can increase the ability of the world to solve pressing issues. Not just innovation in general, but the real focus on addressing any resource-based conflicts and any resource-based issues that are a trouble for the world. That's the work in a nutshell. Maybe I can open it up to some questions and comments. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it sounds very promising. And I'm wondering how, in the last year, things have been going with documentation processes of the recent builds.
Right. We haven't done well on that at all. I mean, basically, last summer we had a full house of like 18 people the whole summer. And we did a pretty decent job, actually, on the brick press. We spent over a month with a team of about 18 people working on that constantly. It produced a large Google presentation on a brick press with very detailed procedures for the build, and then we actually did the build, and then we came back to it and documented more, and we find it filled it with pictures. Mm. But as far as a documentation platform, we're still going around the model of the module-based design, breaking things down into the modules, tracking that through the Dozuki index on the wiki. The Dozuki is a platform where we have all our 50 machines broken down into modules, and then we develop the individual modules. But, I mean, there is a block there. That it's not easy to fork. I mean, we still haven't figured out how to fork that, or when we start new projects, it takes an effort to start new projects. So we have a bit of way to go to have a turnkey way to start new projects, to fork, or to take feedback back in. And GitHub is a part of that. We haven't been using it, though. So we do want to develop these protocols, and we're doing that exactly. There's the development method working group that we're starting. So if you guys, Andrew, or if anyone is interested, we invite you to just email me, martin@opensourceecology.org, to get involved in that. We're planning, next week I'm actually going to the conference, but we're going to have a lot of meetings the week after that. So if you guys are interested, let me know. I mean, that's a huge issue for the community. Today I just met with some people who are developing a layer on top of GitHub to address exactly this issue. So we've discussed, and this is the group that's they're working on an open source electric unicycle, but they've actually done a lot of work. They've seen all the problems of what it means to build upon others' work. And the trouble is, in open source hardware, that you don't need to track only the design itself, but also all your design choices, many, many other pieces of information on top of what you have, so that essentially every single build is a fork. And then if you follow module-based design, so this is what we were discussing in this meeting today, the module-based design means that some modules can be iterated rapidly, others may not be getting changed at all. The overall machine is made up of a bunch of different modules, so overall it makes it a pretty formidable task to track it all. But these guys are on course to putting a layer on top of GitHub. They're creating a platform to do this, and they're rolling this out in the near future. So we're actually going to beta test this platform.
It seems like a massive issue for hardware development is to have the CAD software that allows the tracking of any module, and to see how, you know, when a module gets, see all that module's version variations and exactly what's different, which is just a massive task. I mean, making open source CAD software, I think it would consume lifetimes of any single person.
Right.
It seems to be a missing link to be able to allow us to understand what changes are happening in each build.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's just really difficult, and I don't know how the most advanced CAD packages do that. I mean, maybe that's something to look into deeply as far as what is the best state of art in it, but certainly in the open source, nobody is close to that even. So, I mean, and what's really tricky is that, you know, because of the complexity, you've got the logistics, like, for example, your build here will not have the same sourcing or machines used as the build in Australia, so you have to adapt it for local sourcing. They have a database of all kinds of sourcing
local
supplies worldwide. There's a huge level of complexity and you have to track all of that. So basically when you fork, you have to bring all the former information forward, otherwise you're either reinventing the wheel or...
Every time.
Not
every location.
Yeah.
It seems that we really need a open source CAD package that's procedural and has these kinds of abilities to reintegrate any of those changes that have been forked. So like there's like a review stage where you can see, oh, that module got changed to this over here, let's go to this one. And, yeah, the more I think about that, the more I'm like, wow, I need a whole team of people to do something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And the question would be, is there any hints how to get there? I mean, does it really mean that it's a major, major undertaking? I mean, who would be, is OSC's role to do that? I mean, for OSC, what I'm thinking is that, I mean, as far as the development process goes, our approach is simply, yes, that is needed, but right now, first, start with an overall development process, which we have somewhat in the development spreadsheets, basically procedure for, okay, how do you go from A to Z in a development. What we're trying to do about that is first just refine the tools that are used for that. And, for example, if you do, you know, if one of the steps is CAD, and you ask, well, what are the best procedures for CAD? Maybe the best procedure there actually addresses some of these tracking issues. But what we have to do is just study the best things from around the community that are happening And in our development method working group,
Hello?
Did we lose Marcin?
I think we must have. Marcin, if you can hear us, I don't think we can hear you. Well, I guess we'll be able to log back in. Sorry, who else is with us there?
This is Matt Andrews from Vermont.
Okay, cool. And what was it? What was one of your key focuses? What interests you?
Well, I'm interested in housing construction. I'm taking classes at Yestermorrow, which is a little school here in Vermont. That focuses a lot on architecture, energy-efficient systems for buildings, and also I'm just interested in kind of the community development and business strategy side of the development. So those are things that it seems like OSC is getting into organizing a new strategy and approach by putting together these working teams. So I'm just hoping that I can plug in because I was there. Actually, I visited to help build one of the micro house, the second one, last April.
I mean, I was there too, so we must have connected.
Yeah, it's Andrew
from
Australia.
Yeah.
I'm sure, yeah, I do remember. I do remember.
I'm just trying to visualize you.
So that, I'm amazed at how international OSC is. It's wonderful. We had a couple people from Australia, in fact. There was at least one other person, right?
Yeah, there was an older fella from New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
His name Mark, perhaps. One of the things that I've been starting to get the ball rolling on is I think a really good model for education and building revenue is the makerspace model.
Mm-hmm.
And currently I don't believe there are any makerspaces with the intent to use their revenue to continue open source build.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them do build on like amazing systems, but they're not replicable because they're usually from salvaged materials. So a lot of makerspaces will slap together their own CNC torch table or something like that, but it doesn't mean that anyone else can do it. And they usually don't document what they're doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to create a makerspace where it's a serious chunk of its revenue is devoted towards doing open source R&D. And one of the first targets I'd like to aim that at is a torch table.
Wow. It seems like there's a lot of to building anything. There's a lot of craftsmanship generally involved, and so in order to really make it easily replicable, there really needs to be a lot of work needs to go into simplifying it and making clear designs.
Yeah, that's the hardest part. Is you can save a lot of money if you just recycle stuff, and
mm-hmm.
you can make things way cheaper, which means more accessible for some, but it doesn't mean that the design will translate to another location or even
mm-hmm.
another building that's nearby even, because it's pretty much a one-off thing.
Right.
It's a really big challenge if we're to become efficient in terms of our reuse of existing resources.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that the Brisbane Hackerspace, they're repurposing a giant billboard printer, and they want to turn that into a torch table, which I think is a really cool reuse of an existing system.
Mm-hmm.
I am considering investing in a laser saw, an open source laser cutter, mainly because I really, the platform that it's built on, the BeagleBone Black, and some of the other components, I think could teach me a lot in terms of how I could tackle a CNC torch table.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just have to look at how to solve the rails and belts and things like that in a different way for something that was larger.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it could be a good way to go if you've got... Hello?
Hey, guys.
You know what I mean?
I guess I cut out there. How far did you guys hear?
We've been talking for maybe 3 minutes, 4 minutes.
Okay.
So, yeah, you must have dropped out about 4 minutes ago.
Okay. Did I, was what I said making sense?
Where were we? The last thing you mentioned, we're talking about documentation and issues around using software for integration from modules.
Yeah. Right. The bottom line to that all being... is that much is needed. We can start simply by working with development spreadsheets like we have and displaying them in whatever format we have so that they can go on a wiki or be displayed anywhere as we need.
Yeah.
And that means we also want to have better templates for how the wiki is organized. And I think we can do a lot if we revisit the wiki. I think we can do quite a bit with templates, and actually there's a meeting going on with Wikipedia, with Apropedia tomorrow, where we're going to discuss how we can work with Wikipedia. They have a lot of experience on using different templates and trying to help us manage the wiki so we can use both the OSC wiki and start a presence on Apropedia, since they have been at it for a bit of time, and they can share some experience with us. They can help us out on that. But definitely templates can be quite powerful. Mm-hmm.
On building those templates, since they become
mm-hmm.
the instruction set for a system, if you have another chapter located elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
how do you visualize to make the decentralization and the branding question work? Because usually if
mm-hmm.
someone, say, designs a laser saw and they have all the documentation for that on their website,
mm-hmm.
then that is a big point of revenue raising for that for laser saw and that site. But if we want to have, say, a centralized location for all of that documentation on the OSC site, then that may affect some of the other chapters' ability to generate revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a question I've been, you know, thinking about in my mind? How do we figure out those relationships?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what I see happening is, in general, all the knowledge is open so that anyone can produce it, right? Then the question becomes, who gets to use the OSC name? Or Global Village Construction Set, or Open Source Ecology. And the answer to that is there has to be some form of agreement established for that. So right now, at OSC, actually, we hold the trademark on the name Open Source Ecology. And the way we're looking at it is if you want to produce the OSC machines, you're absolutely welcome to. Now, if you want to use the trademark, that's a business issue, and then we have to have agreements on things like what is quality control. What makes it an OSC machine? Are you actually building what we have, or is it something different? So one is being very explicit about what machine is being built. Like, for example, we have frozen, we have to freeze very distinct versions of machines. And then the second part would be license agreements if someone wants to be an OSC fabricator. And what does that mean? That would probably mean that part would probably mean Jeff joined us from somewhere. Jeff, are you aware that we are also on the conference call, the call-in line, if you're interested in talking to us? So please do that if you'd like, because the Hangout is for video and for some links. The voice is supposed to be on the conference call. Okay, but regarding to the brand and licensing question, what OSC needs to do is to define quality control procedures and licensing procedures where, one, you would, in order to be a licensed OSC product, you would have to, one, follow the quality control procedures that are established, and then have an agreement of what it means. And we haven't drawn any of this up. I mean, if someone wants to produce independently, then we don't have to do anything. But we were thinking that a potential revenue model for OSC would be that we provide training and licensing of the brand. So if someone wants to be a producer under the OSC brand, then OSC would have to spend energy on it. There's some costs involved with that. And the benefit for the licensee, of course, would be that they get publicity. They might get being featured on our website or using our communication channels or whatever services there are. So the whole package of how that comes about has to be created as we build up. And that's the thing we need to develop pretty soon, because if we're talking about the Brick Press, which is our farthest product, and if we're going to release the final products, the product plans, and the enterprise model, we're actually expecting a significant number of replications to happen. And we want to encourage people to start their own enterprise, and we also want to encourage them to use the OSC brand if that's what they want to do. But that does mean go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, well, mm-hmm. one thing that's really interesting about the question of whether or not someone creates their own brand or uses the OSC brand is that if they're located at different centers around the world, their ability to fundraise and raise revenue is a really hairy question, because, you know, I'm sure OSC, say, has a lot of donors that exist in Australia, and if someone were to use the OSC brand name here, then how do you approach the question of how fundraising is distributed to the different chapters?
You're asking a good question, how the various chapters would raise funding to bootstrap their work.
Donation-based funding, which is why, an incentive for someone to go off and create their own brand, because there's no confusion or politics around that issue if they were to do that.
Right. So one way is to absolutely start your own brand, but it would be nice if we can help that, because so what are the value streams there? OSC gets the value of people actually building their machines, which is good for OSC. We want that. We're seeing replication. We want to encourage that, because that simply means there's more energy in the project. It's in our interest to do that. But if someone does do that, we don't want them just to go out there and say devalue our brand by producing crappy product or doing something different that's got different interests in mind. So there has to be discussion and very specific agreements on what that relationship is. That is all
On that issue, that is why I've come to my current approach, which is rather than try and say risk diluting the OSC message if something were to fail, because I know that you've had many others try to use that brand name around the world and they're basically non-existent. I think that an approach that protects both parties until value is to see from both sides is for me to create my own brand, which is going to be called Open Civilization, mm-hmm. and for that to be able to get to a point where it's building things in collaboration with OSCE, and when it's clear that it has value, to then mm-hmm. have the discussion to plug in and use the OSCE brand name after that point.
Yeah.
And that way,
but also,
that way both are protected.
Absolutely. But then the question is, what exactly are the standards that are we measuring against, right? So there has to be some paper trail and documentation. And we don't have to look at it as bureaucracy. We look at it as, this is documentation of exactly what you are doing, so that in line with our distributive enterprise concept, if that's the level you're taking, because I could see like two levels of collaboration between chapters. One is that you simply produce the product. But the second level was that you also document and produce the enterprise model, which would be the next level. It might be that we want to, and I haven't thought about it enough, but I think as we go into the future, we definitely want to encourage people. Like, it really excites me to know that somebody else is out there and they're going to share their information on how they started their business, what their economics are like, so that it helps many other people. And in that way,
sure.
OSCE is quite motivated to help them out, make sure they succeed. But once again, the clear standards have to be there. Like, and I think we can do this in an extremely lean way. Like, for example, if you're doing the fabrication, a quality control procedure would be simply, okay, there's these quality control steps. It could be as simple as, okay, for this, take a snapshot, take a picture of your fabrication at this particular step to show, you know, whether these two parts fit or whatever. So it could be as simple as uploading images to document that, oh, yes, it has this, or here is the test result, or some one form or another. So we can virtualize that. We can facilitate it, so it's not some mysterious, you know, like what you know, for example, ISO 9000 or whatever. What is that? Well, we have to make it very transparent what that certification means, and for that we have to create a product label, some protocols for what that quality control procedure is. So the main thing would be the quality control procedure. That would be the biggest concern is what exactly are you building? You know, if we work with you like that, I want to make sure, Andrew, that you know, you can send me a picture, send me documentation, that I know what you're doing and I can stand for that. Therefore, when I talk to somebody, oh yeah, Andrew in Australia is producing our machines according to spec, I can have confidence behind that and I can recommend you. Because if it's not transparent to me, I wouldn't feel comfortable about recommending you. The bottom line is the transparency of that whole process. And I think it could be made pretty lightweight to meet not only the quality certification requirement, but also the learning requirement for others. You know, others can look at that and say, oh, yeah, look, that's a great job. Oh, I can learn something from that. You know, so it would be multiple purposes served by the transparency. Now, this all is some of the things, like within about 6 months, we really have to nail some of this. First of all, like when we deploy the plants for the machine, we are planning on a very explicit quality control procedure that's outlined in very, very much detail for every module in the whole build. So that means, okay, at this step, check this, you know, or have you checked that the corners are ground, or this part fits to within an eighth inch of this part, and that all can be documented in the build process, in the instructions, so that when you have the final product, you're not guessing whether this thing is going to work. Because I mean, you've seen it, the alignment issues. How do you make sure that this thing is aligned, you know, that the drawer is going in and out properly or the machine is squared up?
Yep.
Well, you can take all kind of very specific measurements and be very rigorous about what that looks like.
Have to be able to document and show that accuracy process. And we kind of did a pretty good job of that, at least figuring out how that would work. But no one had thought about it when we were doing prior to the build. It was all happening on the fly.
At that time,
improve that accuracy.
Well, I mean, you saw the build that was in early of 2014, and we just didn't have that documented on paper. That's why, at certain points, people didn't know what was going on. And at that point, me as
I think I wrote it down in my log actually, how we created that process.
So I mean, we had some. I mean, we didn't have all. We definitely didn't have all. We had some checkpoints, but the point of a finished product is that that is as exhaustive as it needs to be to make it very easy to check. And then, of course, it can improve at all times. We, you know, we develop new techniques for how to do a certain step. That can be a live document, but also we are very clear about which version somebody's building, what version the modules in that machine are, so that it's a transparent process and we don't lose information. Because we have already suffered from the thing where, like, basically after 2011, when there was all these new versions of, say, the BrickPress, the documentation collapsed because modules were getting mixed up, didn't really know. And it's that problem of that you have to have the awareness of the entire project whenever you go into it, and that's the part that's challenging about the documentation. Yeah, but, I mean, we should collaborate.
And software developers are very aware of it, because the attitude of any wise company that knows about this issue is, if someone made something that's very important to your company, you don't ever let them go. The companies that let them go don't realize that they end up losing a lot of money, because the next developer that comes along, if it's too big to tackle, eventually they will probably rewrite the whole thing.
That's exactly right.
That doesn't always happen. If the developer's really good and the prior work was also really good, but those two things have to occur for the previous work to not be lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a huge challenge. I mean, the real question is, if the documentation for a project is too long or messy and somebody doesn't read it, and I think that happens quite a bit, then it's effectively as if that documentation didn't exist because nobody was able to use it. So, and that's where the standards, I think this is where we have to talk to all the different open source hardware projects and start talking about standards for how people's documentation is more uniform. I'm really serious about that, because I see these tons and piles of missed potential in this overall process, and I really want to address that, because if we have ready access to all these different modules, I mean, the development can happen so much faster. We can be cracking through the material security issue for this planet, as opposed to, like, you know, every company has to reinvent the wheel.
I feel a key part of that is that for any chapter, they have to have a key person dedicated to documentation, and that person works on documentation for multiple projects, wherever they are in that locality, because it needs to be centralized, but then those people could communicate about the templates they're utilizing. So you might have, you know, a documentation guy in Australia talking with the doc guy in Missouri, but it needs to be a full-time thing, which means that, I think that they need to get paid, really. Like, you need to somehow have those guys there all the time, because the documentation is the hub of it.
Right.
I saw when I was there that when I was, until I was, like, you know, taking the bull by the horns and going, right, I'm just going to make documentation my responsibility, then it worked with me, just making sure that it absolutely happened and that every little detail was covered. But without that key, like, central person that makes it their thing, it just wouldn't happen.
No, absolutely. There has to be somebody that's doing that in a very dedicated way, and that's been part of the issue. Without having money that we're earning to keep a person for a long time on that, that's a huge challenge. Now, what's the best way to address it? I mean, the best way, I mean, the thing that's becoming very clear to me is we're going nowhere without these machines actually starting to generate revenue, because then people just come and go. I mean, that's the classic problem. we need to start supporting people. So the way I see it, like if it's, if there's a chapter, like for you guys are going to start making things happen. You're going to generate revenue, and then you can start paying yourselves to provide those necessary functions. So the way I'm looking at it is I don't want to hire like all these people worldwide, right? It's impossible, first of all. So the way I would like to see it, the vision for that is,
whoops, did we lose him again?
I think we might have lost him again. So,
oh boy, you're just getting to the really interesting part.
And he's probably going right now. So if we just remember, he was about to explain, rather than having to pay someone dedicated for documentation or people all over the world, what his potential solution for that was. That was what he was about to explain.
Yeah, I remember what he was talking
when he,
about, so you can pick right up again.
When he connects back, we'll just tell him that's where he's at.
Yeah. That's kind of the question I've had, because my understanding is OSC is a non-profit now, right? I mean, it's primarily, you know, it's running workshops at the factory farm and doing a lot of educational work.
Yep.
But if you're producing...
Well, a non-profit can pay people.
Sure.
Non-profits can. Yeah, they can pay people. It's just that they can't, like, say, go on the share market or give returns of investments to shareholders and stuff like that. You know, that's that's the main differentiation. And that also when a non-profit's created, it's created with a charter such that if it ever ends, that its assets are basically given away to a similar venture, not to a single person, so that no one benefits for from that non-profit's asset. That's my understanding of the differences so far. I mean, there's other little stipulations here and there, but...
So I guess if OSE is forming chapters, would they be? I guess they would be affiliated. So in a way where if they ever folded, their resources would go back to a headquarters or something like that, rather than just being dissipated.
Yeah, it depends, because a lot of the, when organizations get big, they can be hybrids too. So, you know, for example, I might have one organization called Open Civilization, which is like OSE. It has the, you know, its charter is to make open source hardware. But then attached to that, there might be a makerspace, which is more like a private corporation, and it actually can... It can have generate profit, but that makerspace can then say, well, we're going to divert like 70% of our revenue back to OSE because, you know, that's basically the purpose for its creation. Like, so, for example, Open Civilization is giving them the makerspace, $30,000 to build a tool set. So it's sort of like you can define these are hybrid relationships so that you can also utilize the best of both worlds. But yeah, in terms of
I think that it's really interesting to think how you know, people may, you know, if for production might want to form different kinds of organizations, like, you know, limited liability corporations or partnerships or, you know, cooperatives. And those might be, you know, more typical like business models, but then somehow have an affiliation with OSE.
Yeah.
So that they're not not trying to reinvent everything themselves independently.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the big ones, isn't it? Because I feel like for the start, it's good for me to start off with a separate brand until those relationships get defined more organically, and then when we get to a point where we go, okay, we both agree this model is going to work for us, so at that point, I would take on the OSE name instead. And what's the other thing about that? I just decided it was the easiest way to start without being reliant on someone else to create documentation for me to be able to function, and then be able to reassess that later. Is March in there? Is that March in?
I think that's the dropping noise. I think something happens where he gets disconnected, and then the phone service doesn't realize he was disconnected until a minute or two later.
I think only Martian's been disconnected. I got disconnected because I ran out of credit. So that was a valid disconnect. But Martian's been disconnected twice, and you haven't, have you? So.
No, I haven't. I'm calling in on a landline, though, so maybe that's the most secure form. Do you know, is he calling on an actual phone, or is he using his computer?
Don't know. Not sure.
The old wire going into the wall usually the least problematic.
Yeah.
Hello.
Marchin's back here. Comments from
right.
Jeff. Jeff in Stuttgart. Okay.
Marchin, if you'd like, we can fill you in on where we lost you.
Go ahead.
You cut out just as you're about to explain. Instead of hiring people all around the world for documentation, you were saying you see that happening in another way. And at that point, you got cut off. So we're talking about...
Andrew, repeat that. Can you explain?
We were talking about having dedicated people for documentation in order for in order to make it work. And we were trying to figure out how do we see that happening on a global level.
Yeah. So you're asking how to do that. Well, I mean, what I would do is have people pull together. Like, if there's a number of OSE chapters worldwide, I think we should get them all. Like, for example, if we're working on a brick press, I would suggest we get everybody to agree that, okay, we know that everybody's pulling on a brick press. We have a working team on that. And through that working team, we cultivate a person who's responsible solely for the documentation and have that maybe a couple of people so that when one person leaves, that part never, the documentation never goes away. So there's always somebody responsible for that. And eventually, maybe we end up with a whole global community starting a movement where we, as a global community, we fund that person or do things. I mean, here's the deal. What I would like to create, and this is the whole purpose of these extreme manufacturing workshops, when we run them, we can start contributing money, like using that money on things like the documentation person, or that documentation person participates in running that workshop, so we don't have to pay them, they run it, they get the money, they can keep operating. So my model is, in order to make it very, very simple, like I don't want to look over, or like, you know, I don't want to run that workshop for him, if I can teach him how to run the workshop and he can make his money. Right? That's the way I would like to see it happen in the future, that we're focusing our efforts on training people, providing the working enterprise models that we don't have to babysit them to, we don't have to be their parents to give them money. They are the responsible core developers that make that happen, you see? So I'm being, you know, very, I mean, it's kind of rigorous on that, but I think if you want to scale to the global effort, we want to be decentralized. We want to have as little of the centralized funding happening as possible. You want to start distributing that economic flow to all the different branches. so that they're responsible.
Yeah.
They're capable and responsible for themselves. And that's how I think that's going to be the key to scaling.
I absolutely had already thought that that was the way it should have to work. I guess that it is a challenge from the get-go to have just a dedicated single person that is a hub for documentation in any center.
Yeah, but, I mean, okay, but Andrew, look at this. What if, what do you think about the idea just shooting out there? I mean, what do you think about the 3D printer model as a bootstrapping way to fund projects? If we develop the model where we can run very successful workshops, and you run that workshop in Australia, and you get revenue that you can operate on for a bit of time and start bootstrap funding things, do you think that would work, for example, or is that too hard?
No, I mean both that and something like a brick press are both very attractive. I see that is a pretty strong possibility. I mean, there are a lot of people in hackerspaces that make 3D printers, but I think that you can certainly make it more accessible because you should be able to teach anyone how to put a 3D printer together. I'm pretty convinced that you could do it. But also, what about the design of the thing? Because, like, if the greatest 3D printer that's open source at the moment is the TAS, it's still not that nice to use. It is an amazing system.
But depends which one you're talking about. Are you talking about the latest one?
Yeah.
The Mini?
Because it's the TAS Lulzbot. No, not the Mini, the Lulzbot, the big one.
Yeah, I mean, they're really at the next generation. I mean, they've developed automatic bed leveling in the next one, and it's apparently, I mean, actually, they donated one to us, so I'm going to actually test that. But apparently,
do they have that in the Lulzbot, bed leveling in the Lulzbot now?
Yeah.
Or just in the small one?
They have it in the small one, and I think the latest big one has it.
Oh, my God. Okay, I'm buying one.
No, I mean, totally. My point is that, I mean, we have direct access to that technology. We can talk to Jeff right now, Jeff Mull. He's the CEO of Lulzbot, and he's actually willing to help us on this. That's why I'm considering either that or the ED for the 3D for EDU version from Michigan Tech, from Joshua Pierce's group. They have a pretty decent version. But we can work with these people to make this happen. So we are definitely starting a 3D printer working group on this. Would you be interested in joining that too?
Yeah, I would be. Yeah, because the 3D printer is like quite accessible. The parts are small, you know. So when it comes to shipping, if you're shipping in small blocks, it's easily achievable.
Yeah, totally.
Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. Jeff, who's on a call, what's your email so I can follow up with you? In development process, development group. Yeah, so we are going to start the 3D printer group with the explicit goal of leveraging this for possible funding. Now, there's another part to that. Whenever we run a workshop, we generate 24 people with that printer. We are also generating an army of potential prototypers, people who can do small-scale models, which we want to get more into. We haven't done much of that at all. We hardly have done it because we could hardly keep our printers running at factory farm.
Yeah.
I mean, there were definitely a lot of calibration issues and bed leveling. The bed leveling was painful. Was impossible for the novice. I mean, that's what we found out. So maybe with that, we can get many people prototyping the parts. Like right now, we can definitely prototype a scale model for the brick press to see if all the parts fit together, you know, things like that. We can definitely do that. It takes a little bit of time, but if we have so many people around the world doing that, we can have a de facto global prototyping army after this takes off. So there's a reason to do that as well. And in fact, what we wanted to do for the 3D printer was also put a simple 1-watt laser head on it so we can cut out paper scale models that you can fold up, just like we did with, like for example, the backhoe prototyping. We did, we cut the tubing, the tractor tubing, out of flat pieces of paper that we folded up into tubes that had the holes in them. So that's a, and combine a laser with the 3D printer. Yeah.
Mm. Very cool.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely keep me posted on that. You have my email, so...
yeah, are you following our Facebook? That's where we post... You're on our Facebook, right? Yeah, definitely. So...
Yeah.
I
also wanted to fill you in on some of my thoughts about the CNC torch, because one of the things that really interests the local community and Starseed is having a CEB press. And...
Mm-hmm.
If we were to, one thing that I see as being really important if we're going to do continued replications of that big process is to get the torch table going. And
yeah,
that is a project that really excites me.
Mm-hmm.
I have been considering putting a big chunk of my savings into a laser saw, not only as something that can attract people to the makerspace, but also as a learning exercise for me to potentially look at a similar platform to operate CNC torch table from, because it would be cool if a large percentage of the components were similar to what was in the laser saw, even though the laser saw is very expensive. Those are what my, that's me thinking out loud. I think it would be very cool to have an open source CNC torch table that uses a similar set of components to what the laser saw does, bar a few things.
Yeah. Okay, so how does the laser saw fit? You're thinking a laser and torch in one?
No,
different machines.
So basically using the laser saw as an educational exercise to really see something that operates very well, because the feedback on that system is really good, and using its design as a template for then designing a CNC torch table, but it would not be the same. It would be larger.
Right.
The laser saw I see as a twofold investment, one in my own education for future R&D and the other as something to put into the makerspace to attract people into the makerspace.
Absolutely. Now, the laser saw is excellent. It's very expensive. And so these guys there's another project out there that we've just been in contact. Some other guys that are building on a laser saw to simplify it. Some people from Slovakia. Actually, I am very much interested in the CNC torch table. I mean, we of course, as you know, that's a critical machine for building all the equipment. We have not got a development group working on that, but maybe. So, if you look at working teams on the wiki, there's 2, 4, 6, 8 that we are getting going. I think we should actually add the 9th one. I mean, the torch table is definitely... I mean, the torch table and the CNC machine, which Jan from the Velocar project is working on hard right now, those two are very, very important machines in the set, and they are nipping at me, and I think we might want to just start that as well.
Yeah, cool. Well, so, I think that where I am here is a pretty good place to get going on that, although obviously our space is still in development. The Brisbane hackerspace I've been connecting with them today, actually. They've been working on various CNC systems. Like, they've repurposed an old banner printer, which is massive, and they're repurposing that into becoming a CNC torch table. They've got laser cutter in there working and a bunch of other systems. So I think that collaboration with them on development on an open source CNC
table. Sorry, on the Torch table?
It's very cool. Yeah.
Very large, highly interested in it. How much talent do they have for the actual development?
Well, I'm about to find out about that, but I've connected with two or three people there already that are pretty skilled, and they're having a launch party tomorrow night, which I'm going to, so I had to connect with a chunk of their members. They've got about 30 members that are coming in regularly. I think that there's good potential for collaboration with the Brisbane Hackerspace in the meantime until the Byron Makerspace is actually pumping.
Yeah. So you're interested in Aquaponics Greenhouse Working Team and the CNC Torch Table Working Team?
The Aquaponics Working Team, I feel like it would be a bit too much on my plate right now, actually.
Okay.
I'm interested
in CNC Torch Table. Is that your absolute priority?
CNC Torch Table is my priority, and the 3D printer working team as well.
Okay. I think we should make it happen. That makes it a total of 9 teams. I think we can handle that. And what we want to do is develop a leader for each of these so that as this gets going along, up front, I want to be involved as the time goes on and we're actually, you know, more on track. I don't have to be there.
Yeah.
Initially, I don't want to be there.
We can add Devin and Anthony to that team too, just because they've had a fair bit of experience the last attempt, and they'd be
add who?
Good advisors for me.
Devin?
Anthony and Devin, yeah. Because they were working.
Devin who?
Last. Devin Ward.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm sure they'd be able to give us some good advice.
Yeah. Well, that sounds good. So we'll have you for two of those. Jeff Schulman would like to be on the development method working team. There's a lot of, he's bringing up issues about documentation standards, file formats. Yeah. There's basically the new approach. So maybe let's actually wrap up because I kind of got to go get going. But let's do, so we're going to continue on these working teams, which is a good segue. And the general idea is, there's a lot of people that want to work on these things, so finally to organize, get better organized on different development teams is a good idea. Now, the outstanding thing is, once again, Andrew, as you asked and as Jeff points out here, we do need to definitely revamp the documentation, and I think partly with the different templates on the wiki and the development work that's happening right now, that's an active process of development. So as we go forward, we make sure we stop losing all this information, because, I see that definitely as a big bottleneck. There's a lot of lost knowledge that's happening within the project at this point. So,
And
but
is
no,
there
this,
anyone
this is exciting.
Working on those templates now? Or?
Sorry, say that again?
Is there anyone working on those templates now, or is that yet to happen?
On the Torch table?
Templates for documentation, just generic
no,
templates.
No, nobody is working on that. Do you want to join that team as well on templates?
So we have, just fill me in a bit on where it's at, because I remember we were using Dazuki and we had the Excel spreadsheet. And I can't remember where else, what happened after.
Right.
I don't know
it's basically Dazuki as an index and then going back to the wiki. But I think we can improve that quite a bit if we create templates. So, for example, instead of having an extensive spreadsheet, you can put a lot of that into a template. So even by using very simple tools, we can do much better. Yeah, we have to rework that. Okay. Yeah. No, that sounds good. Okay, guys, so I need to quit at this point.
Yeah, so keep me tuned in with the documentation as well. Then definitely.
You want to get
really
in there
important.
Too? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So basically, that would be the development method working team. Mm-hmm. Because development slash documentation is the same thing, really, in some way. Okay, that sounds great. So I think we'll wrap up here. So thank you guys for participating. I think there's a lot that we're going to get accomplished this year. I really want to see the project take off, but we got to start generating revenue with things that are actually working. So I think there's a lot of progress that we can build on. So I'm optimistic as ever. Okay, so thanks, guys. We'll take it from here until the next True Fans Hangout at the end of next month, last Thursday of the month. March will be the next time. Thanks a lot, guys, and take care.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bye-bye. Catch you at the motion.
Thank you.